Well, you better ask me the question so I can have something to say.
Well, here with John Sigurdsson with the Law History Project, and also Graham Zilm and Doug Harris sitting in, who might throw a question in conceivably as things go along.
Any questions are welcome. That's fine.
Cool. So if you'd like to start with your background and then move up through your life. And
okay. I'll just give you a very general background. I was born in 1948 in Winnipeg. I essentially grew up in Fort William, Ontario. Moved to Vancouver when I was 12, going into grade 7, and I was educated on the west side of Vancouver. Went to Point Grey for a while, and then Prince of Wales High School when it was a new school. And did my undergraduate degree at UBC. I did that in economics and political science. Took a year out at 1969 and traveled down to Panama and then over to Europe and came back across Canada. In my absence, I took the LSAT exam in London at a time when the test didn't count for anything. It was the first year that it was done at the law school. It was a practice test to get the test built into the system. So we took it with a bunch of American students that it meant everything to, and we were taking it in Berkeley Square. In London, it didn't mean anything to us. It was just kind of a lark. And a lark in Berkeley Square. I didn't. And I came back and started law school in the fall of 1970. So that's how I got to law school.
Can I ask about your? You said you're from Manitoba. Are you Icelandic?
Yes. Yeah. Icelandic Canadian.
Gimli, Manitoba. Is that the?
Of course. Yeah. We've gone back there for Icelandic reunions. My parents and grandparents are all Icelandic, so I'm pure Icelandic, so to speak. But three of my four grandparents were born in Canada, so that's how long we've been over. And I had our dog who passed away a year or so ago was called Gimli. So there you go. Yeah. Okay, I'll wait for your questions, or I'll just keep babbling on. So.
Well, no. And as an undergraduate, you specialized in economics and political science,
right?
And was that a good training for law?
I'm sure it was as good as anything else. It never really, you know, captured me as much. I mean, to be quite honest, I wanted to be. I knew I wanted to be a lawyer. I'm not quite sure why I wanted to be a lawyer. My grandfather, who died during that Spanish flu of the 1918 era, was the only lawyer ever to be in our family. So being a lawyer was a revered thing, although there weren't any in the family. So I'm sure I had this notion, I'm sure my mother put it in my head when I was young, that being a lawyer was a good thing. So I had that notion that it was something I wanted to do. So, you know, I have a feeling that a lot of my course selection as an undergraduate were focused on courses that I thought I could do reasonably well at because I wanted to get into law school. You know, I wasn't a particularly good writer, so although English may have been more interesting or history have been more interesting to me, I was a little unsure whether I'd get the marks I wanted to get into law school. So there you go.
And did you ever find out how you did on that LSAT in Berkeley Square?
Yes, yeah, we got the marks. The marks were done differently than they are now. They were out of a big number, like they were either out of 800 or 600 or something. You know, I did okay. I didn't do as well as some people I know, but it was okay. If as long as you tell me the marks are destroyed, I'll lie about it now. But if you're going to cross-examine me, I won't go there any further. Yeah. But, you know, it's interesting how important it is now and how important it was to the people that we took it with because, you know, all the Americans were applying for law school, and that was really the only common denominator, so it was so critical to them. And you can see that it was sort of my first introduction to the tension of law school exams, which, you know, I saw in law school but hadn't really noticed yet.
And so that was 1970?
That was 1970 when I started here, yeah. So the 60s were over and, you know, a whole new time had begun. And so I came to law school. I mean, the law school was, of course, in the old building in those days. It was very interesting, you know, because we just got, there were 260 of us, so it was sort of a big class, and we were allocated to four sections, and I was in section three, where my wife was in, my wife-to-be I met in section three, and so it was quite interesting how, you know, how random life is, that, you know, you meet these people, like my best friend, Steve Kelleher, who I later became a law partner, you know, he was my best man, he's now a colleague on the court, you know, just down that we, you know, we're lifelong friends. I met that day, first day in section three, and a number of other pals, so it's interesting how randomness sort of dictates what happens in your life. But so that was law, and I think it's kind of different now. I think people have a pretty good idea what going to law school mean and what's involved. But, you know, I had been away for a year. I hadn't really thought a lot about what law school was going to be like. So it was sort of a completely brand new experience. And it was sort of the first time that I was doing something that might have a serious impact on what I did for the rest of my life. You know, I mean, I didn't think I was going to be a political scientist or any economist, right? So that was, in some ways, just sort of putting in time, although I kind of enjoyed it. But law was the first time when things were going to be serious. So, and law school was very interesting. I mean, it was it really grabbed my imagination. I did a lot for a lot of people in first year law. The concepts were interesting. The method of teaching was something I hadn't really seen before, which was fun. And we became great friends. We broke into study groups and, you know, developed great relationships. And so it was good. It was a good year.
What were your first impressions of the law school?
Well, it was a little different than I expected, I guess, because looking out the window here, I see Brock Hall, and my university life had really been on the other side of Brock Hall. Like, I'd gone to the arts building and all the buildings to that side, but we'd come to coffee at Brock Hall, and I don't remember when the Student Union building was built, but Brock Hall, at the beginning of my time at university, was where the students would gather, and the lawyers in those days, the law students, were still of a different breed. I mean, they were still wearing jackets, and they had, you know, short haircuts, and, you know, everybody else on the other side of the Brock building was sort of falling into the 60s, and their hair was growing longer, and it was getting quite different. So when I went away for a year and came back, I don't know what I expected. I expected to see more like the law school that I had seen glimpses of at Brock Hall. So I was a little surprised, because it was a pretty shaggy bunch, you know, if you look at the pictures of our class. I mean, everybody was sort of that era. I think we were all kind of a little overwhelmed by the whole thing. I mean, this was all an important time in our lives. You know, we heard the stories of the number of people that failed, and when you haven't seen anybody perform, any of your classmates, everybody looks like a genius, right? And they all, so I just thought I was here with a pack of geniuses, and things are going to catch up with me, so.
John, you mentioned that your encounter with teaching was different here. There was a different style of teaching from what you'd experienced in your BA. How would you characterize the way you were taught?
Well, first of all, was the case method. I mean, we'd never done the case method before. I mean, essentially, I mean, we deal with issues in a different way in political science and economics, and the Socratic method was brand new. So it was essentially the study of the case method to deal with principles was a new thing at the law school.
And how rigorously Socratic was it? Was it really a class where professors led students with a series of questions?
Some more than others, but not really seriously Socratic. I think we were all a little frightened at the beginning, so any semblance of a Socratic method would sort of, you know, freak us out. But, you know, we had in first year, we had Jim Matkin, Bertie McLean, Barry Sletsky, a fellow doing legal institutions from the States. He was probably the most Socratic, but it was probably the least appropriate from his perspective because he didn't necessarily have the basic information that the teacher has to have to be able to operate as a Socratic teacher. But it was, you know, it was different. I mean, I think more, it was more the case method approach to studying and understanding legal issues, which was kind of most interesting. And then in study groups to be able to deal with these concepts and get our minds around them. I mean, we would invent scenarios and sort of present those to our study groups and discuss those, you know. So we very quickly got into that method of dealing with legal analysis. So it was fun.
And what professors made the strongest impression?
Well, the strongest impression on me was we had several good ones, and different students liked different ones. Like Bertie McLean was generally very, very popular, and he was such a good professor. Jim Matkin, different people liked him because Jim was sort of the absent-minded professor. So some people found him a little difficult to follow, and others thought that was the science behind his teaching. My favorite professor was Chris Carr. I don't know if you know Chris Carr or not, but Chris Carr was from England. He was only a year or two younger, a year or two older than some of us, but he taught contracts, and which was my favorite course in first year law. And he was fabulous. It's a brilliant mind. He died about 3 years ago, but he went back after he taught here at UBC for several years, was on the Law Reform Commission as counsel in BC, and then went back and became a barrister and a QC and a very, very highly regarded guy in London. And when he died, I read the obituary. It was typical Chris Carr. He was on his fifth wife, and his third and his fifth wife were the same woman. And the obituary kind of talks about how, you know, a typical day would be doing a case in the House of Lords and then getting on an airplane and flying to Hong Kong and doing an arbitration on the weekend and flying back. And so when he died of a heart attack, it wasn't surprising necessarily, but he was fabulous, and he just caught my imagination for some reason, and I've always loved contract law as a result.
I think Leon Goetz mentioned him too.
Yeah,
there was another Englishman.
Yeah,
instructor here who he also mentioned. I don't remember.
Wasn't Leon South African?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, sorry. Well, there was Richard Field and Chris Carr. Mm-hmm. And this was part of the George Curtis. You see, the George Curtis thing was he brought over in the year before we came and the year we came. Not that we knew about it at the time, but he brought over all these young professors. I don't know where he found them all, but he was Chris Carr, Richard Field, Bill Black, Steve Wexler. His very first class was our very first class, right? I mean, we arrived here at the same time. And a number of others, I think, that it came a year before.
Michael Jackson,
you know, same. So there was this crop of very, very interesting, vibrant young people. So it was a kind of a nice mixture.
What was Curtis's hiring policy? What did he go around the world? Did he have a network?
You know, I have no idea. George was George really wasn't that seen that often around the law school when we first arrived. I mean, by 1970, the law school started and went
45 officially started, but I think first students start coming in 46.
Right. So he'd been there for 25 years, right? So by the time we arrived. And he had other things, and I think he traveled a fair bit. And I think through his travels, that's how he made these connections. What his hiring practices were, and how it all happened. I was going to tell you a story, but I won't tell you. I was just thinking about meeting. There was an event at the when the law retreat, and we were all. Went out to Harrison. We were all in first year, and so we sat down for dinner, and I sat next to this woman, and she asked me who I was, and I explained that I was about to ask her who I was and who she was, and I thought, well, I probably shouldn't be asking that question. It turned out I was George Curtis's wife, right? So anyhow, that was an event. I'm not sure they have that event anymore. Do they have that?
No, for good reason,
right? George was a wonderful dean, and I got to know him more, obviously, through the years. I mean, he's lived in the neighborhood until he died, and a wonderful guy, but somehow had the knack of attracting some very skookum sort of people in those years when we were here.
John, could I just ask about a little bit more about your classroom experience and what type of law it was you thought you were being taught? There's a very internal approach to law that's doctrinal and contained, and then there's an external approach that sees law operating in a social context, and I'm wondering about the balance between those two approaches, and I guess within the internal approach one can be quite theoretical or practical and vocational. Was it your sense that you were being taught a body of theory in which to understand the law, or were you being trained to go out and set up a legal practice?
Oh, well, the phrase you used, social context, was not a phrase that arose in those days, right? I think that we were essentially not being taught to set up a legal practice, but the understanding was, by and large, that there are a series of legal principles that arise in different contexts, and to be a proper lawyer you have to have a good grounding in all of those principles. I'm not sure, Doug, I'm answering your question properly.
Well, I guess in part I'm wondering whether, looking retrospectively on those hires that George Curtis made in the late 60s and 70s, he was bringing in a crop of faculty who were engaged with law in society in a way that perhaps the earlier group of professors wasn't.
Sure.
Like Steve Wexler and Bill Black and Michael Jackson, all sort of very conscious of the social role that law plays.
Right.
Although very doctrinally based as well. And so I'm wondering whether you were aware of a transition that was happening in the law school.
I think so. When you point out Michael Jackson, for example, if you compared Michael Jackson's family law case course, which wasn't taught in first year, but was taught in second year, I think at that time, if I'm correct, or beyond first year anyhow, and someone like Professor Herbert's family law class. Professor Herbert was a very doctrinaire, traditional sort of approach to family law. Whereas Michael Jackson's analyzed, the expanding social issues that surround family cases. Trying to think of some of the stuff that he would be teaching. But it was quite a different, that was probably the starkest example of the difference that was brought about by those new faculty members. So, I think there was a significant change in that respect by bringing those people in. You know, Steve Wexler had you know, a different view of things. You know, he wasn't intending to just teach a criminal law course, which is what he taught us, but something with a broader social context, because I think his background at that time was poverty and the law, if I recall correctly. And I mean, it was quite interesting because in first year he went down to Las Vegas. I don't know if you know this story or not, but there was a, what was the situation there? Steve Kelleher went on this trip, but some of the students went with him. And they were signing up people for there was some issue about people on social welfare not being able to vote or not being on the voting register or something to that effect. That made me forgetting the issue, and he was interested in that issue and thought, well, he'd go down, and during the break he asked some students if they wanted to come along. So about, I know that Steve and Myron Claridge and a couple others, quite disparate sort of people, went along and had the experience of doing that. I'm not sure that would be applauded today, but it was just very interesting. And you know, Steve, in terms of the different things, I mean, this was the day where you've heard of these grants that they gave to people. What were they called? They were a government program. You would devise some sort of a program.
LIP grants?
Yeah.
The LIP grant?
Yeah, LIP grants or something, or another name like that. You'd say you'd want to create a library for, working mothers in the downtown east side or something. So you'd get $3,000 and you'd hire 4 students and you'd put that together. And the group that Steve didn't put together but sort of encouraged some people to do was the Vancouver Welfare Rights Organization. So we applied for a grant, and about 5 or 6 of us worked at it that summer. And we'd go around. The idea would be that we'd go around and help people on welfare understand their rights and their appeal rights and that sort of thing. So it was kind of an early student clinic for welfare rights organizations. And I know that arising from that, there was an appeal where somebody challenged the amount of social assistance that they were receiving, and it was increased from X to Y dollars. And that probably, it was an education in how the law works, because that probably led to legislative change. And either that was the end of the appeal process or that was the end of that. So we learned how the world worked pretty quickly. So, so those were sort of interesting times.
We hoped to talk to Mike Harcourt, and we'd been told that he was involved with a clinic as well.
Yeah.
A legal clinic. Is that early? Is that before?
That was earlier. Mike was in the class of 68. I think that's the graduating class. So he was there. He graduated 5 years before our class, and his... And I think, on that video that we looked at, Mike said very briefly that they styled that program after some of the clinics that they'd visited in the United States. So it was a student free advice clinic that they set up, which probably still goes on to this day, doesn't it? And probably in a big way.
So there still is LSLAP, and I'm not sure if this was an early incarnation of LSLAP.
I think it probably was, yeah. I'm sure it was, actually.
Okay.
Yeah, but Harcourt would know all that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
but there were other examples of this kind of outreach into the east side or into the poorer parts of Vancouver.
Yeah, I mean, one of the biggest ones that arose from somebody in our class was drawing a blank, Diana Davidson and the People's Law School, right? Which still goes today. Now, I think, correct me, you'll have to find this out from Diana, but the People's Law School might have started from the same kind of a grant, right? And I think it's had its ups and downs in terms of its size, but in terms of legal education that it provides to the public generally, it's done remarkably well. And that was just something that Diana and a few people that were associated with her started and pushed for many years. So I don't know.
And were the students divided politically, ideologically, because it was an era of, it was the counterculture era. Was there an obvious kind of right-wing, left-wing split among the law students, or was it a...
Not to the same degree. I mean, there were people that were further left. I don't think you'd say it was a particularly political class, right? I mean, people were kind of there focusing essentially on getting on with their education initially. My perspective now from a distance is that you can identify young people on the political spectrum more easily than you could in our day, you know. Like, people tend to be sort of capitalistic or right wing, and they didn't reveal it as much in our day. It was a little bit before the money that could be generated from the practice of law was sort of on the table. We knew that the next step for us down the road was the practice of law, but I can still remember we didn't look for articles until the summer of second year. So really, first year, there'd never be a discussion about a law firm. I mean, none of us, my family and my dad was a professional, so I would have met a few lawyers, so I would have heard of a few law firms, but we wouldn't necessarily know the names of the law firms. It didn't mean anything to us. I articled at a firm called Bull Hauser, and I don't think before the summer of second year when we were going out looking for articles that I had heard of that firm or any of those firms, right? So what I'm saying is I think that nowadays, I'd be surprised if these comments would apply to first-year students nowadays. I think that, by and large, they have a pretty good idea of what's out there and what the future lies, and some of them have very definite views of the money they want to make from the practice of law and that sort of thing, but I don't think that was really much of a consideration in our day.
Could you say it was more of a professional education at that time? More of an academic, of a university-based education? Because we heard from someone we talked to, and I can't remember now, in your first term, you're encouraged to visit someone who will advise you on what to do after 3 years. So there's very much a, you'll know the details of this. But so you didn't start to think of your career until a couple of years into law school. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think so. And that's only speaking for me. I mean, I'm not sure what everybody else had in mind. But I wouldn't look at it necessarily as a, people saw it as an academic exercise. I think people went there thinking that they were getting this to be able to have a profession / trade, ability to earn a living with it. But I was really answering your comment about I thought you were asking about the sort of the political spectrum of the class, I think that we were all realizing that at the end of it we were going to come out and get a job, but I think we were still enjoying, being at university and not really getting into the real world. So, putting it off as long as we could seemed to be an acceptable way of doing things.
You said at first you were intimidated in the first class or two. When did that wear off?
I'm not sure it ever has.
Why?
No. No, I mean, Well, first of all, it was this initial thing that everybody looked like. I don't know whether you've had this, but you know, you always feel that you're going to hit that wall where you know you're past your point of your abilities, right?
The Peter principle.
Yeah, whatever it's called. Yeah, and I mean, I'd faced that in undergraduate when I did mathematics. Like, mathematics is sort of one where you know people have sort of obvious skills or lack of skills. So, a lot of my friends just couldn't figure out calculus and trigonometry, but I was quite good at it. And so I thought, oh, I'll take these courses. Then I got into second year math, and I started to realize I could see where that ceiling was, you know. And I kind of thought when I went to law school, gee, I wonder whether this is what this is going to be, you know. And but yet it sort of seemed to sort of fit my interests and my way of thinking. And so I became more comfortable after Christmas exams. And Christmas exams were really quite a... the first time I'd ever really felt any tension in a in an exam setting. I mean, there always is, you know, an undergraduate, but this was kind of, it meant something. And even though the exams, and I don't know if they still do it this way, but the exams didn't count for your final score, but you know, they were kind of a test to, did you know how this worked? And so getting past that with reasonably good marks, even though I thought that I'd sort of freaked out a little bit in the exams, sort of gave me some confidence that maybe this is going to be okay. So I don't think I ever felt totally comfortable or got rid of the view that everybody else knew a lot more than I did at a law school. But, you know, over time, you became more relaxed.
Mm-hmm. What were your first year classes? What was the set that you got in the first year?
We got legal institutions, and in first term, and civil procedure, I think it was called civil procedure, something like that, was the other half of that. And the other ones were all full-year courses, and they were property, torts, constitutional law, contracts, and...
Criminal,
yeah.
And so there was no choice in your first year?
No
choice were set?
Yeah, no choice, yeah.
And in the second and third year, did you feel as though you were being directed towards a set of courses? Were there requirements, courses that you had to take? Did you have elective options?
There were elective options, but you had to take evidence. You had to take trusts, I think. What else might have been an obligatory case? I'm trying to remember. I mean, we took courses like conflicts, which wasn't a compulsory course, succession.
Evidence.
Yeah, evidence was a obligatory compulsory course. We took secured transactions, which was with Ellen Zisblatt. He was a very good professor, I remember. I had a different professor I won't name, and I sat in on Professor Zisbot's class for the entire term. I think he was surprised when I didn't show up for the exam because he thought I was in his class, but he was very good. There you go. It's funny to answer these questions because a lot of these notions I just haven't entered my mind for years. Yeah.
And the other students, were was there an urban-rural split? Were some from small towns in BC, or were they mostly from the Lower Mainland?
I would say most of them were probably from the Lower Mainland. There were some from around the province, but not a great number. There were a number of people that I knew through the undergraduate system from Vancouver, but my recollection is mostly of kind of a Vancouver-based, Lower Mainland-based class.
And was the expectation that you would go into practice in the cities?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we all kind of looked for articles in Vancouver. But, you know, the great thing about the law school was that, you know, everything was pretty well open. And, I mean, I had no notion of whether I wanted to be a litigator or a solicitor or what the practice of law had for me. And I ended up doing litigation. You know, so I left law school without any particular preconceived notions of what my practice would be. And that kind of, that developed as I did my articles in the first year or two of practice. So, I mean, I think it was pretty good law school in terms of providing you with, you know, all the options. I think the law school's come a long way, though. I mean, I think the research skills of the students that I see come from UBC are better than the research skills that we had developed. I think they're better writers than we were, and I think that, you know, the focus on that has been very useful. It would have been good if we'd done more of that as students, but I think that's just a matter of developing a curriculum and how you teach at the law school. So,
how much writing did you do for assessments in your classes?
Oh, you know, not very much.
It was 100% final acceptance.
Pretty well. There are a couple of courses that had paper options, you know, but those are few and far between. Mostly it was just exams. I mean, we did a consumer protection course with Chris Carr, and what did we do? We did a paper and a survey, I believe, of local government. I'm just trying to remember. But anyhow, so there were some courses, some seminar courses, where you could do different things. You could do papers, but not too much of that. You know, by and large, it was just starting to change. I mean, it was, you know, the class 3 or 4 years before us would have been entirely exams, and you know, some of the new blood at the law school were introducing different things. It was changing a bit, but not too much.
What was the articling process? How did you go about that?
Well, we'd sit around in the coffee room and we'd talk about what law firms people knew about, right? Mm-hmm. And we'd sort of get information that, you know, this is a good firm or they're hiring students and so forth. And so I picked 4 or 5 firms that I went to. Like I said, I went to Bullhauser. Why I ended up going there or interviewing there, I really don't remember today. And, you know, the interview process was very interesting because, you know, you'd meet one person and you'd draw an impression of what the firm was like from that person, right? So if you met a nice person, you think, well, this is a pretty good firm. And if you met someone who looked like they were working in a coal mine, you thought, this is a pretty bad firm. And I had that impression. I mean, I remember one big firm I went to, I thought, oh, my goodness, what a terrible place this must be. And that was just that one person. I know of now it's a fabulous firm, but I went to Bullhauser and I met Bob Orr was one of them, but Bob Orr was one of the UBC graduates. He was a very interesting guy because he had been in the automotive industry all his life, so he went to law school when he was probably 45 or almost 50, so he was his claim to fame was he was fired by Lee Iacocca from Chrysler, so that he was one of those big execs at in the automotive industry. So, and I was really taken with Bob. He had a great attitude and loved law, loved UBC, and sort of sold me on Bullhauser as being an interesting place to work. So that's how I ended up there.
Did you receive more than one offer?
Yep. I think my dad was well known in the community, so I think that gave me an advantage. They thought, well, I mean, my hair was sort of down to here, and I got it cut to here, and so that was a major accomplishment for the interviews. But they probably thought, well, you know, if he's anything like his father, he's probably worth taking a risk on. So that's probably why I got several offers. But anyhow,
what did your dad do?
He was a chartered accountant. Brought the family out here in 1960, set up a firm at Dunwoody and Company, and worked there for about 30 years until he retired.
John, talk a little bit about that transition from law school into the world of articling and the world of a downtown firm. Was it jarring? Did it seem smooth? Were you ready for it? What was your sense of that transition?
Well, I think it was. I don't think I was ready for it. I don't know whether at the law school nowadays, or associated with the law school, there are any programs or, you know, discussions that you have with students where you say, "Well, this is what it's going to be like at the articling, and you know, do this and that." I mean, it was all brand new, and you know, suddenly you're sitting in an office working, whereas you know, you're just kind of hanging around at the law school beforehand. I think human beings react and adapt so quickly, right? I mean, I think it was a bit of a shock to the system, but we quickly caught on. And I mean, it was at a time where we would get together like a pack of articling students every Friday night, right? And we would just sit and talk and exchange stories about what had happened and this and that. And, you know, we get to wear suits and we're thinking, oh, we're pretty important people and all this kind of stuff. And it was a whole new experience. It was good. It wasn't an easy transition. I mean, because I don't think there was anything at the law school that really prepared you for what articling was going to be like. You know, I mean, immediately you're called upon to do a lot of legal writing that I don't think we had done a lot of in law school particularly, right? I mean, they don't want at a law firm necessarily an exam kind of answer on a situation. I mean, they want the issues discussed, but kind of put the writer to come to a recommendation or a solution. So
yeah, interesting. So I guess I meant by asking whether you were ready for it, whether you thought you'd taken everything from law school that it had to offer and you were ready to move on to the profession, or whether there were a whole set of courses that you'd really like the opportunity to take but that you hadn't yet had a chance to at law school. But you've sort of turned the question really into an interesting angle, which is, did this prepare me for what I was about to do, which was start the practice of law? And your answer is interesting in that you didn't. You almost said, or it sounded as though that it didn't really prepare you, or at least not in all the ways.
No, I don't think it did. Not in all the ways. But it's interesting, the question that you ask about, you know, were there other courses, you know, that I wished I'd taken? Well, that's, you know, that depends on sort of the perspective of time. In our class, I think there were a lot of people after second year that were itching to get out, right? And get on, earn a little bit of money, and so third year dragged for a lot of people. I have to confess, I wasn't in that group. I would have been happy to stay at the law school. I enjoyed it. In retrospect, you know, when I realized sort of what was available at the law school in terms of studying, and I really wished I'd taken a greater variety of courses, or could have taken more courses, had developed my research skills better. Right now, I'd love to go back and take torts, and any time during my career, I'd love to go back and take contracts again, right? And part of that's just interest, but part of that is, you know, I honestly don't think I got as much out of my law school training as I could have by a mile, because I think I worked hard getting ready for exams, but I didn't sort of work hard enough throughout just sort of studying. I'm not being very clear on this, but you know, maybe all law students think, well, you know, if I had to do it again, I'd love to go back and, you know, get what I really could have gotten out of that. But I look at like law clerks that work for me, and some of their skills that they get out of the modern law school. I mean, I think they work harder than we did, and as a result, got more out of it. So, that's a rambling answer, but okay. Yeah.
Property wasn't in your list, but if you ever want to come in and sit on a property class, you're most welcome.
Oh,
to
okay.
Come in.
Well, I'd love to. I'd love to. I'd love to. But you'd call on me. That's the problem. Yeah, if I could sit quietly, I'd be fine. Do people ever do that?
Yes, from time to time.
Yeah.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah, and there's room. Their classrooms are big enough.
There is. There's 45 students in the class, and the classrooms are 50.
Okay.
So
okay.
There's always space.
Yeah.
And it's actually a great delight to have others.
Yeah. Oh well. No. I'd love to do that. And property is one of them.
I wanted to ask about writing, about legal writing. I'm a historian, so I do historical writing, and I'm just got this steep learning curve with law. But what kind of writing do you do?
What do I do now?
Well, yes, and how did that connect? Did you learn how to do that here at UBC?
No, and I mean, what I write now, of course, are reasons for judgment, right? Mm-hmm. And I didn't really learn, I don't think, to be a particularly good writer in practice, because I think the writing skills were a little different there. But, you know, I think I've really learned, to the extent that I can write well, I've learned as a judge, and that's just from writing and rewriting. And you know, I mean I've taken a number of judgment writing courses. There's one offered by the Canadian Institute for Association of Judges and one by the NJI, and they're excellent judgment writing programs. And they really just focus on judgment writing, or writing as any writer would do, the same way you would concentrate on your writing, or an author would concentrate on his or her writing.
And so you'd look for clarity of argument.
Yeah, clarity and conciseness and rewriting and rewriting and rewriting. So, I mean, I enjoy the process. I enjoy distilling something down into a product that's a good product. But if I'm getting back to the question, unfortunately, I think it's something that I didn't really learn much about during my tenure at law school. I think law students do now, and I think it's extremely as valuable a thing as can be taught at the law school, I think. Because after all, I mean, all law in one way or other is communication, written or verbal, often written, and unless you can express in a persuasive way your ideas in writing, they're not much, it's not much use, right?
And I suppose all judges have to go to law school. So
right.
This could be a,
I think so.
So there is a...
I'll check with some of them. Right?
Some of them
I've wondered about
sure.
Some, yeah.
But,
yeah.
But are there writing courses? Maybe Doug, you can actually take courses in writing.
It's an ongoing discussion about the balance between an education that focuses on the substance of law and on the skills of law, or mm-hmm. the skills of practice, and of the skills, writing is one that's commonly emphasized, and it's at least now. But it's interesting to see or hear from you your perception of the shift, where it was maybe de-emphasized early on, but your perception of the students now is that there's considerably more emphasis on that skills side.
Right. Is that right? Is that correct?
I think there are different ways of going through law school, and you could go through law school with more of an emphasis on a skills training, or you can go through law school and largely leave that to one side, and it's still very much open to the student to choose that path through.
Right. But skills, by skills you mean advocacy skills, oral skills, writing skills, is that what you mean?
That's right. So you could choose advanced legal research and writing. You could choose to do a moot. You could choose to do extensive clinical work. Would lead to a very different education than someone who did a series of seminar courses.
Right.
So there's, again, there's very different ways of going through law school now. And my sense, and maybe this is erroneous, but my sense was there was, when you went through law school, there was really a path through law school that just about everybody took, and fewer ways of doing it differently.
Oh, I think that's right. I mean, there were a few electives, but by the time, you know, the 3 years was over and you mixed and matched, there were a couple of courses that people took that were different, but by and large it was the same, you know, meat and potatoes, essentially.
So you had a core curriculum, which most people had to take.
You know, by and large, I'm just trying to think of some of the electives. I mean, electives, I don't know if that's the right term or not, but they were popping up in those days. And there were seminars that were coming up that were different. I mean, I remember we took a labor arbitration seminar. I mean, that was... Yeah. Anyhow. Upset.
John, could I ask about your early days in the profession and your sense of that time of your life, of what it was like to be a young lawyer in the practice of law at a reputable and, for the time, large downtown firm in Vancouver, and how that, how your experience at UBC resonated with that time, whether you maintained a connection with the university in your early years as a lawyer, what that looked like?
Just trying to get those years straight. Well, you know, my situation has always been a little bit unique because of my marriage, right? I'm married to Lynn Smith, and Lynn has always had a strong connection to the law school. And as a result of that, I've always, you know, come along or had the benefit of having a strong connection. When I articled Bullhauser, and I stayed on, and I initially worked with Bill Essen, who later became Chief Justice. And Bill was a graduate of the class of, I think, class of 56 or 57. I think he was a class of 57 because his Jimmy McIntyre was in that class. And the class that was supposed to be so good was the class of 56. Everybody was in the class of 56. Tom Braidwood, Hamish Cameron, all the Tom Berger, all the legal luminaries. And Bill always used to tell me that Professor McIntyre, this is Malcolm McIntyre, used to say, the only thing notable about the class of 57 was that my son was in it, and it was the smallest class we've ever had. I mean, so they're always sort of the poor sister compared to the class of 56. But the point of the story is that I loved working with Bill Essen, and Bill had a very strong connection to UBC. Like, he loved that time. And as a result, I would hear a lot of stories of that era and those people and what law school was like and all of that at that time. So that was kind of a connection I maintained to the law school. Hamish Cameron, who was at that firm when I was first articling at Bullhauser, I think was one of the first lawyers to go on sabbatical, and he came out and was a lawyer in residence at UBC Law, you know, in 1974, and I think that was one of the initial programs, so that was a bit of a connection. But then I, when I was called 1 year to the day, some of my friends had started a law firm, and they asked me if I wanted to join them. And I was completely happy where I was at Bullhauser, but it was one of those opportunities that I thought, well, you know, if I don't do it now, will I ever do it? Will I stay here? So I decided to move, and that was a firm that was all made up of UBC Law graduates. Don Monroe, John Fraser, Rick Watts were all in the class of 1970, so they were in the class that graduated just before we came in the door. And then the firm became Monroe, Fraser, Kelleher, Sigurdsson, Watts, Goodman, Seth, and then became Fraser, Kelleher, Sigurdsson, Watts, Goodman, Seth. So Sigurdsson, Kelleher, and Goodman, Seth were all same year law students, all in the same section. We all became friends and then became law partners. So that law, UBC law connection sort of stamps you and carries on, you know, you can't avoid it. And then Lynn, when we had our first child in 76 and she was practicing at Shrum Little in Hebbenton, started teaching as an adjunct professor, I think in the fall of that year, and so continued to teach courses. And you'll have to get the facts straight. You should interview Lynn, actually.
Mm-hmm. Yes, obviously. We'd like to.
And so she remained in that connection until she joined the faculty when Dean Ken Lissick was the dean in about 1980. And so I guess to answer your question, Doug, is that, you know, through Lynn, who had a continuous connection with the law school, I've always had a strong connection. I've had one anyhow, but that means that increased it, I guess. And so that through those young years, that connection continued. Now, was there any other sort of formal connection? I mean, I don't recall there being much of an alumni association in those days. So we were kind of pretty well away from the law school. Yeah, I might stand to be corrected on this, but there wasn't really any link other than the professional link I had through my wife, or, you know, knowing some lawyers who, and some profs who taught.
If you could talk a little bit about your practice as a young lawyer, so first with Bullhauser and then at your own firm.
Right.
What was your sense of that period?
You know, I was, you know, at a major firm, you know, I was kind of, they moved you around from department to department in your articling period, but people tended to be a little less structured than it's become now. I mean, now they do that to make sure that people get complete articles, but, I mean, as an example, I remember walking into Bullhauser that day in July in 1973 to start, and Mrs. Carpenter, who sort of ran the office, came out and asked which of the two of us was Nils Douglas, because there were two of us that were starting, and Nils, unfortunately, I wasn't Nils, he was the other guy. And Nils was taken to go into the maritime department, and because there was a big case, there had been a collision. This was in the days that was when things were good for maritime lawyers, because the radar didn't work as well, right? So, I mean, ships would go into bridges, and, you know, there'd be major lawsuits, and life was good. But Nils, Nils never got out of the maritime department, right? So whoever's name had been picked out of the hat, because they didn't know Nils from me, would have ended up. So fortunately, I didn't end up in the maritime department. And I articled, and I was assigned to do insurance work when I became a lawyer. I was kept on and became a lawyer. There were six of us, and they hired back four of us. And but I kind of was attracted to Bill Essen because I liked his style. I liked him as a lawyer. I liked the cases he did. So I would always sort of shift over there and ask what he was up to, and he'd say, well, you know, here, come take a look at this, or give me a memo on this. And before I knew it, then I, you know, I was just working entirely with Bill, and so that was, I don't think that would really be kosher nowadays because they're a little more structured about how that happened, but that worked out well for me. And then when it came time, so I, you know, I did a mixed bag of commercial work, and Bill was a very busy lawyer. And nowadays, young lawyers don't get into court, but I mean, in my first year, I had, you know, I had at least three or four trials in the Superior Court of my on my own. I juniored Bill on several trials, went several appeals, and so it was pretty well. Looking back, I couldn't imagine being any better. But when I was asked by my friends to join them, I sort of thought, well, this is the way it is for everybody, you know. So, but when I left and started doing work on my own, I realized that I'd left something pretty good. And so, years later, when our firm broke up, I ended up going back to Bullhauser, but Bill had moved on to the bench by that time. So my practice at a small firm was quite a different. I mean, you know, the clients were smaller, but it was at a time when, you know, we weren't far removed from the 60s. You know, the world seemed to be our oyster. You know, people could go and set up practices and make a good living. You know, we didn't have the income expectations that people nowadays seem to have in the practice of law as young lawyers. But, you know, I mean, house prices were cheaper. I mean, we bought our first house in 1976 in Dunbar for $63,900. So, I mean, you didn't need a big income to be able to have a good standard of living. So practice of law was very interesting. We had a great firm.
This was the Bullhauser
Bullhauser was a great firm, but the small firm was a great firm, and they were all good, very good, young, competent lawyers, and we were doing very well, and things went along well. But then we lost two of our partners who became chairs, respectively, of the Labor Relations Board, Don Monroe and then Steve Kelleher. And then there were a few of us left, and so we were making a decision at the end of 1980, would we carry on as a firm or not? And we decided we would not, and split up our receivables. And I went back to my firm, Bullhauser, and I was there till I went to the bench. So,
how do you go about starting a small firm? You mentioned there were departments at Bullhauser. Did you copy Bullhauser, or were your ambitions smaller?
Oh, they were smaller. I mean, when I say the firm started a year before I joined it, it was Don Monroe and John Fraser started, and then it was Monroe, Fraser, Kelleher. He joined a month after, and then I came along a year later. So I was there a year after the firm started. And yeah, we had a small office. You know, you scratch around for work, but people, by that time, we'd met enough people in the legal profession. There are enough conflicts. You know, you take anything that comes your way, and so we seemed to be busy enough. I did a lot of kind of municipal and real property litigation in those days, just because that's the sort of work that stumbled along, and you did what you could. And I don't really know. I think it's a different world nowadays. I don't know how easy it is for young firms to start off. Maybe it's just as easy. I don't know. I mean, people, you know, people are understand the importance of networking, and you know how networking helps the practice of law. We did it in a more rough and tumble sort of a basis, but I think a lot of young lawyers go out and are able to set up practices nowadays, but I might be wrong.
Was the small firm an apprenticeship in a sense? Were others formed at that time that also collapsed, and was there a lot of turnover?
Not really. Not many firms started. I mean, I think everybody sort of saw ours as being, you know, the next really good firm, and were surprised when it broke up. It wasn't an apprentice. I mean, this was going to be our future, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, this is going to be the firm for
serious business.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Maybe it was too serious. Maybe that was the problem. No, but it was it was, you know, very good, and we had good times. And, you know, I think if the core group had stayed together, we probably would have practiced for many, many years together.